Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of September 26th. And we're pleased to have another one of our editors' roundtable discussions. We did these bi-weekly over the summer, and we're going to try to continue doing them monthly during the regular publication year. And we have joined with us Father Ray Schroth and Carrie Weber. Welcome to you both.
Thank you, Tim.
Good to be here.
We have three subjects to discuss, so let's get right to it. The first is a widely talked about, cited review biography of Malcolm X by Manning Marable of Columbia University. And I want to begin here, before I pose a question to you, Ray, with a quote with somebody who was really moved and taken by the story of Malcolm X. I should preface this by saying that this person did not find necessarily the work of other African-American writers, Baldwin, Ellison, Hughes, Wright, quite as compelling. Only Malcolm X's autobiography seemed to offer something different. His repeated acts of self-creation spoke to me. The blunt poetry of his words,
his unadorned insistence on respect,
promised a new and uncompromising order, martial in its discipline, forged through sheer force of will. All the other stuff, the talk of blue-eyed devils and apocalypse, was incidental to that program, I decided. Religious baggage that Malcolm himself seemed to have safely abandoned toward the end of his life. Now that is actually our president, Barack Obama, writing in his book, Dreams from My Father. So, Father Ray, you reviewed the original Alex Haley book, and now again in America in this issue, the new biography. What is it about the story of Malcolm X that you have found compelling over the years?
My first reaction from the Obama quote, religious baggage, turned me off a little bit. I know what he meant, but religion is not baggage. But some religion is, and some religion is very harmful. And to a degree, Malcolm X's religion was a reforming moment in his life. I mean, that's the one thing that turned him around, was a new religious concept.
Sure.
And I approached this book with some combination of anxiety and anticipation and challenge. I was what I find out now that I didn't know before, because I'd written about him three times from the other books. First, the column I had in America, where I was supposed to write about politically relevant new books that people were talking about, often that would concern younger people. And so Autobiography of Malcolm X came along, and I did a piece on that. And then later, when I was in theology, I did a longer piece on Malcolm X, in which I compared his conversion to Karl Rahner's theory of the so-called anonymous Christian, which was to be open to experience is to be open to grace, and to be open to grace is to be open to God. And if you're open to God, then without knowing it, you're a Christian. And I think the conversion process that was described in the autobiography was consistent with that. So what was I going to learn from this that I didn't know before? And I'd say a lot, but especially about the complexity of his life. In many ways, Autobiography was a message book, and you're supposed to put it down and say, wow, this means something to my life, which is exactly what President Obama experienced. It helped him discover himself at a time when he had a lot of other baggage with a lack of family background, etc., that would determine who he was going to be in the future. So I can see this as being effective on that.
Yes, and it's a book, as you referred to, is on the curriculums of high schools and colleges around the country. One of the things I found compelling about Malcolm's story and kind of reacquainting myself with it, reading the reviews, was the fact that he was self-educated. When he was in prison, he read all of these books. And then later, when he became such a great orator, it was in part because he could draw on this great knowledge. So here was somebody from a very humble background, was a pimp selling drugs, may have even, some of the books suggest, may have even been a prostitute himself, and yet was able to kind of rise up and educate himself. So that's truly inspired.
I'm glad you brought that up. Because on the one hand, yes, it was a marvelous thing he did, the way he educated himself, which included reading all 10 or 12, I think that was maybe 14 volumes of the Will Durant History of Civilization. But that they're an excellent sort of review, that's everything that has ever happened anywhere. That would be very good for someone like himself. On the other hand, education is a little bit like medicine. You know, someone who medicates himself may not medicate himself well, all right? And if you educate yourself, there are a lot of limitations in that, because you are not exposed to critical thinking the way you really need to be. And I think the great tragedy of his life, when I got to the end, was in some ways how little he had changed from the very beginning. And I think because he still had a violent streak in him, he was very teed off at Elijah Muhammad for having sexual relations with these various women and having children from them. On the other hand, he was not faithful to his wife in those later years. He was not a good father. He called for the assassination of a policeman. When the policeman in California, after a black riot, had killed a black man, he went back to his mosque friends and said, I want to form a hit squad who will take out the policeman. Now, somebody talked him out of it, but this is supposed to be the new Malcolm.
So this was this was post his break of the Nation of Islam.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So what if people had gotten to him when he was a teenager, right, and given him a real kind of education and background and support that a young man needs to develop a fine mind, is what he had, and his marvelous political instincts. He was in his 20s. You're pretty well formed emotionally, morally, etc., when you're at that stage, and so I don't think he ever escaped that.
You wanted to end with a quick quote, kind of summarizing the life and influence of Malcolm X. Why don't you do that for us?
I'm quoting the Holy Cross 100 books, which is something I put together with the help of a lot of faculty up at Holy Cross in the 80s when I was there. And I end up, I say, on one level, Malcolm X books is like other black classics, Richard Wright's Native Son and Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, about a black man's struggle with the illusion of the American dream. But more fundamentally, it is a religious story about a man who transcended racism, ours and his own, and discovered the possibility of universal brotherhood because he was constantly open to experience and not afraid to change. And I think that's still true.
Yes, I think I should end by mentioning that I quoted him in my high school yearbook. So there was obviously something about his story that did transcend race. I might have been awfully earnest as an 18-year-old. Let's transition to something that Carrie is here to talk about, which is a place we both recently visited and is connected in some way with the struggle for African-American rights. Actually, very closely connected, is the memorial to Martin Luther King in Washington. Carrie, you visited recently. What were your initial impressions?
I did. Well, actually, one of the reviewer in the New York Times might argue with that last statement, as he was not particularly pleased with the connection between the actual monument and the struggle for civil rights. So that's one of the complaints that has been voiced among many complaints about this new monument. However, I went to the monument before I read this review, before I had any real preconceived notions of it, and I found it extremely moving. I went at night. It was sort of lit very well. There were tons of people there, and everybody there was sort of a feeling of being united with everybody. It really was a very peaceful place. It was, and all of the quotes along the wall were really, I thought, well chosen. One of the things that was not ideal, I think. Originally, they had wanted to have water coming down over all of those as the waters of justice, and it very symbolic. And they had kind of like two mini fountains of justice.
Which you can easily miss.
Yeah, which are, especially at night, I barely even saw them. So, you know, that I don't know. Maybe they should have just gotten rid of the water idea altogether at that point. I found it to be extremely, extremely moving, although there has been some debate about the quote on the side, which is a condensed version of a quote from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., which he said something along the lines, "If you want to call me a drum major, call me a drum major for justice, call me a drum major for peace, call me a drum major for righteousness." And due to space constraints, it now just says, "Call me a drum major for justice, peace, and righteousness," or something along those lines. And so, as Maya Angelou has noted, she said it makes him sound like an arrogant twit. So, but, you know, this memorial has been in the making for a long time, as many memorials are, I guess. It takes a long time, and I don't think you're ever going to make everybody happy. So I think for most people, if you go and you visit it and you aren't concerned about the cartoonish mountains that the critic in the Times is sort of criticized, and you try to think more about the ideas that it represents, I think it's enjoyable.
I haven't been yet, but the pictures I've seen of the Martin Luther King just struck me as, of course, I say monumental, as if you're looking at a mountain.
It's 30 feet tall, which is actually taller than the Jefferson and Lincoln Memorials. Yeah. I was surprised at that.
And he was a little guy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, everybody's little to you, right? You're a tall man.
And it looked like something I might see in Budapest or Moscow or something. Looking like Stalin.
Well, some people have criticized his sort of stern look. Yeah. You know, he has his arms crossed. He's kind of looking down. It's not a very, you know, pastoral, comforting image.
Yeah. No, it is sort of Soviet in its...
He's in rock.
His
menacing
look.
Coming out. But as I was looking at it, you think... it sort of does imply a sense of struggle. He wasn't just, like, cheerfully going along all the time. It was a hard life. It was a hard struggle to go through. He shouldn't be just sort of grinning away up there. It doesn't really go... I think, with the sense of struggle. And then if you think, oh, what was he thinking about? Then you can go look, and there's all those quotes there. Because it does make you say, like, what was he thinking that would make him look so sort of stern? And then you can walk along the wall, and it'll show exactly what he was thinking.
And I think it suggests, too, that the struggle is not over. That this isn't something... I mean, I think that's a temptation with Martin Luther King, to say, oh, we have kind of overcome our racial prejudices. As Cornell West in the New York Times, in an op-ed about it, it's important to remember that the latter part of his life, he was fighting hard against war, against poverty. Right. These are issues that are still existing, yet those get kind of glossed over in his legacy.
Right. And I think some of the quotes on the walls represent
exactly.
More of
I think the quotes do. I mean, the criticism is that it doesn't play up the struggle for African American rights of his
right.
Men, but it puts up these issues of peace and justice that are still very much relevant.
Well, while I was in D.C., I also went to the Basilica of the National Shrine of the Immaculate Conception, and there they have the Our Mother of Africa Chapel, which has a sculpture there, which I think actually maybe better represents that struggle, in a sense, not Martin Luther King's legacy itself, but there's sort of a bas-relief structure inside the chapel where it depicts African-American people sort of through the years and as, like, first in slavery and then sort of rising up out of that. And the first figures are very, like, low relief. You know, they're almost still just etchings on the wall. And as the time, as these figures move on and time passes, the sculptures comes further out of the wall. And then the last figure is sort of standing in full round at the edge outside of the wall, upright, very, like, tall and proud. So I thought it was really very moving.
That's a good comparison. I think it is moving on the mall to have a memorial to a man of the cloth, a man who is not a politician, somebody who would have, you know, was not part of the upper echelons of society.
Right.
These quotes about peace and justice, is, I think, after visiting the war memorials, are an important contrast and something that I think long-term people will look to, and I think it will have some real staying power. Well, we're going to transition here to a column that we're our final subject, written by David Brooks just a couple of days ago, on the question of the moral compass of young people. He's referencing a book, I believe it's called Lost in Transition, by Christian Smith and a number of other sociologists, part of his ongoing study of faith and young people. Ray, maybe you can begin by just talking about, you've read the column, what is your experience teaching in Catholic schools? Is this a problem in Catholic schools as well as non-Catholic schools?
I taught college for 40 years, and I didn't find much difference in the generations that I went through. I read the column, and one reaction was, well, what's new? If you get any bunch of students chosen at random and ask them a question that has to do something with something complex, you're bound to get, well, you know, kind of, I sort of go for that. Sometimes I don't. And then, sometimes it's different because it depends. It depends on how you feel that. I don't think that's a good way of knowing how their minds are really operating if you want to measure the content of their minds. I think where he's quite correct now, he says they can't talk and they can't write. And I say the reason they can't talk is because they can't read. And I think reading has fallen so far behind in high school and in college that chances of being illiterate in that literal sense when you've graduated, that you're so unfamiliar with the heritage of the language and the heritage of the morality represented in literature, as well as in philosophy and theology, that's going to show. I think a better way of measuring where the college brain stands is a student newspaper. One of the things we do with Conversations Magazine, which is it goes to all 28 universities, it's read by all the faculty, I get 4 students to write for each issue so the faculty know what's on student minds. And finding the students who can present themselves, I usually start with the college paper and I find who's the best writer there and write something that speaks for your generation and where you stand. And one of the things that is outstanding in the most recent years is their devotion to public service, especially these trips to Nicaragua and to Salvador. And they're very socially conscious of the suffering of other parts of the world. On sexual morality, they pretty much make up their minds and they don't listen to the church, and where you can say, well, why should they? We've not done a good job, right, in trying to present that.
Well, let me quote here briefly from the David Brooks column just to give people a flavor of what he's talking about. He's saying that there is this atmosphere of extreme moral individualism. Now, this doesn't mean that America's young people are immoral, far from it, but they have not been given the resources by schools, institutions, and families to cultivate their moral intuitions.
Right.
Now, Kerry, you went to a Catholic school. Catholic institutions, Catholic colleges would seem to be one place that would try to cultivate these moral intuitions. What was your experience?
You know, on some level, it's very similar to anywhere else. On another level, I think maybe we had a program called the Development of Western Civilization. And so
This is at
Providence College. And everyone has to take this class. Which, as a freshman, I thought, oh my God, what have I gotten myself into? Yeah. And then by the end of sophomore year, when it was done, I was extremely grateful for it because it does offer exactly what the column is saying is missing. It gives you sort of that framework in the context of history for those kinds of decisions. And in theory, you can read that and still kind of have your own relativism and say, well, I know this, but I'm going to do whatever I feel like doing. But at least you know it. At least you have an option to sort of subscribe to some of the like long-held tenets of morality that are there. So I think in that case, at my college, you were able to get those. And I think anybody who takes some of these classes may. But maybe if you go to a place where that's not mandatory, or where you're a biology major and you have to take 1,000 lab courses, that it may not be as easy to sort of have access to that, especially when a lot of schools don't have a core curriculum in the same way. So,
yeah, I can point to my experience. I went to Catholic schools all through grammar school, high school, then went to a secular college. And I would say that it was difficult to find a place that provided this kind of structure. The place I naturally went to was the Catholic campus ministry. But I think the problem that faces some young people is that there is a wide gap between what the church is teaching on some of these subjects and what certainly the secular university is. Questions of sexual morality high on that list. What happens sometimes is I think some people either just reject the church entirely, right, or just embrace it very strongly and reject the secular culture entirely.
Right.
So that's the danger. Yeah. Trying to find the place in between is the hard part. And I was able to, by frankly reading magazines like Commonweal and America, that's sort of where I found that voice and that community. But Ray, why don't you jump in?
I've done some studies of the Cours and all the Jesuit schools, and by no means does everybody take ethics before they graduate.
Right.
And there's all kinds of things you can substitute for that. That's the one place where you're allowed to be taught how to think methodically about a moral issue.
Ray, I thought you brought up an interesting point about the idea of the millennial generation being very sort of justice-oriented as far as trips and everything, because it would imply that you need to, that some moral decision must be made to just say, you know, this is an injustice in the world that I want to help or you know, to help abolish or to work against. And so, like the column says, it's not that people are totally devoid of morality. It's just that if somebody else picks a different thing to work against, it doesn't really hurt me.
My experience, at least being in a secular school, is that that was sort of the, not easy, but it was the natural way to kind of be faithful on campus that was in keeping with the larger values of the university, was to go on service trips. And because this was, you know, it would be another thing to go and kind of, you know, speak against contraception, for example, you know, or same-sex marriage. That would have been much more polarizing. But to go on a service trip is something that both the Catholic chaplain and your professor would endorse.
Right.
So it was an easy way to kind of bridge that gap.
Sure.
It was still commendable, but I think it's that may be one of the reasons for its attraction.
Right.
So.
One of the things that did surprise me about the article was it said that when asked to describe a moral dilemma, they couldn't come up with one, which was kind of interesting thing. They named things like whether or not they could afford to rent an apartment and whether or not they had enough quarters for feeding a parking meter. And that second one was just like, that's just a logistical problem. There's not really any morality involved or not. I mean, I guess if you're deciding whether to skip out on paying for the parking meter, that there's like a moral
That's disappointing.
Thing to that.
Well, we probably don't know what the dilemma is. That's a technical term where you must make two choices, both of which will hurt.
That's helpful, right? Because that's sort of a classic. That's something I think that's been lost. I think dilemma is widely misused in that sense.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this has been a good discussion, and we've already gone too long. But I want to thank both of you for the stimulating talk, and hopefully, we'll get you back later this year.
Thank you very much.
I have to read another book this year.
It's a moral dilemma, right?
Thank you.